is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Many of us have had a friendship with someone who turns out to be not who they appeared to be. Our guest Walter Kern's relationship with a man who called himself Clark Rockefeller was based on years of lies and deception. Rockefeller, not his real name, was not only a con man, he was a murderer. Kern tells this chilling tale in his new book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. The book begins in the late 90s when Rockefeller asked Kern to drive a disabled dog to New York where he lived, and ends with Kern visiting Rockefeller in prison where he asks him, what's the key to manipulating people? The reply, vanity, vanity, vanity. Walter Kern is the author of several novels, including Up in the Air and Thumbsucker, both of which were made into feature films, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Walter Kern, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Are you a naturally trusting person?
Yes. I grew up in a little town in Minnesota that I say makes Mayberry look like the South Bronx. Naturally took everybody at face value, and everybody rewarded that trust with kind behavior.
Are you a less trusting person now as a result of this relationship?
Absolutely. I'm at times a person who borders a little on the paranoid, and it's
really
important to confess it because having had the experience I did, it would be easy to, you know, either isolate myself and ignore the lessons, and I'm trying to do something in the middle.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know you, and as a reader reading through the book and obviously knowing how it ends, all through the book I'm saying to myself, how could you be so naive? How could you be so trusting? How could you not see this guy was manipulating you?
Well,
and that's, of course, knowing how it ends, that he was manipulating you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, this book is the story of a con, and we all know going in that it's the story of a con. And this guy, I sort of sum up his greatest hits as far as his biggest deceptions, his most incredible stories, his strangest inconsistencies. So I make it easier for the reader to be a step ahead of me. But I can tell you that when it was all happening, stretched and spaced out in time, though every red flag did get my attention, they were far enough apart and they were covered well enough by a very masterful liar that none of them stopped me cold.
What made him such a good liar, would you say? What was such a good con man? Because you weren't the only person he conned.
He used your own imagination against you. So, for example, he'd tell people that he was related to a woman named Elizabeth who lived in England. And then he'd later tell them, I'm going to visit Windsor this weekend in England. I'm going fly over. And people would think, oh my gosh, that's the Queen of England. That's his aunt. He would lay out breadcrumbs and allow you to sort of connect them. And he knew that a conclusion you came up with in your own mind was more powerful than something he told you. So it was really the same tricks that I use as a storyteller, as a novelist, but magnified and used in real life.
I mean, it sounds like he almost read you or knew you. And you were a younger man back then,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Knew you better than you knew yourself.
Oh, he did know me better than myself. I mean, he was like one of those poker players who looks at you and can tell which twitch and which, you know, gesture means what. I think he knew, first of all, that I was curious. But he also knew that if he extended his trust to me, I would trust him back. Mm-hmm. So when he asked that I drive him this dog all the way from Montana and take care of this, you know, precious task for him, I felt like he had placed faith in me and I wanted to return it.
Because you wanted to please him?
I wanted to please him, but I was also fascinated. I mean, I'm a journalist and a novelist. I was a young guy, always looking for characters, always scanning the horizon for a good story. And here I'd met a guy who, you know, said he lived next door to Tony Bennett and worked as a freelance central banker. I had to meet him.
So not that you were conning him, but you were looking to him for material, and he was obviously looking to you for, what, manipulation?
Well,
just the pleasure of manipulation?
Well, you know, over the years, depending on what I learned about him, I've had different theories as to why he befriended me. And my latest one is that he wanted to be a writer himself, and he wanted to know a writer, and he also wanted help because, in fact, he wasn't an American. He was a German masquerading as one. And though he wanted to write novels, he was he suspected that he wasn't very good at it. And I think he ultimately wanted my help, which I refused. But in any case, what I wanted from him, I think, was what we all want from interesting other people. A sense of enchantment, a sense of amusement, a feeling that life was livelier in his presence than it was otherwise. You know, he was a character.
But you write in the book, I found him instantly annoying, a twee, diminutive hobbit of a fellow whose level of self-amusement seemed almost delusional.
Yes, that was my very first meeting with him in LaGuardia Airport. You know, I failed to drive this dog all the way across the country and had to hop a plane because I was having a nervous breakdown. The poor animal was so hard to care for. Mm. Anyway, when I saw him in the airport and he started in with his sort of Great Gatsby-like old sport kind of talk, I was a little annoyed.
You say, and this is talking about being a writer, which you were then and you are now, a writer turns his life into material, and if you're in his life, he uses you too. Again, this sort of notion that you saw something that you could use for yourself in this relationship.
Well, as I was driving out to meet him for the first time, having talked to him on the phone and, you know, thought I was going to meet a Rockefeller and a very eccentric one at that, who said he'd never tasted Coca-Cola and, you know, never eaten in a public restaurant and so on, I was imagining a book or imagining a story or an article of some kind. When I got to meet him, the sort of good boy Midwesterner in me kicked in, and I thought I can't bust his privacy. But I was looking to use him in a way that was, I think, a little bit more benign than his intention.
Well, indeed. But his lies, for instance, that he had, keys to all the rooms or all the doors in Rockefeller Center, that he had an apartment underneath his apartment that actually had a staff of servants.
So the first weekend I met him, he put a full court press on me, using all the props at his disposal to convince me he was this important guy. And the first night we went out to dinner in a skyscraper in New York that looked down on Rockefeller Plaza. At the end of dinner, he patted his pocket and said, "You know, we can take a private tour. I have the key." And I said, "The key?" And he said, "Yes, the master key." Now, those plans kind of dissipated. It was late at night. But the next day, I went over to his apartment and saw his very expensive, multi-million dollar collection of Rothkos, Pollocks, etc.
Right.
And, you know, when I saw those, I was sold. If the paintings were real, he had to be.
Even though he let his dog lick the paintings.
Well, that was even more convincing. You see, while I was standing there looking at these MoMA-worthy canvases, he pointed out that there was dog hair on one of them. In fact, there was dog hair inside a plastic box that housed a Mondrian. And then a restorer came in, or somebody who was posing as one, I don't know now, and started wiping the paintings off, and he explained that the dogs liked to lick them. Mm. Some of them were standing against the wall, not even hung. And his casualness, his sort of carelessness about this great art, seemed to prove even more that he was some fabulously rich kook.
You think he was trying to seduce you? And I think one of the reviewers of your book used the word seduction.
Sexually, you mean?
No, I don't even mean sexually. I mean just the seduction of...
Absolutely. It was all a seduction. It was, you know, he had prepared the stage, you know, like a seducer will, you know, put flowers out and, you know, burn candles and scent the air. He had prepared the stage for my arrival, and nothing was an accident those first couple of days. I realize now.
Do you think there was something sexual about it, since you mentioned that?
Well, you know, he gave me a strange vibe, and this guy was a sociopath, and is. And I've done some study on that particular syndrome. And they tend to use their sexuality to get what they want, and neither be gay nor straight. They have what's called fluid sexuality, according to the books. And sometimes I got a vibe that, you know, he was a little too close.
You said he reminded you in certain ways of some of the people that went to Princeton when you went to Princeton.
Yeah.
I mean, and not a particularly flattering picture. These sound like they were the sort of very upper-class WASPs who sounded like Katharine Hepburn, who went to Princeton.
Yes. I mean, he spoke in a very affected way. I say in the book he sounded like a cousin of Katharine Hepburn. Right. But I'd heard that voice before. I'd heard it at Princeton. I hadn't known any actual Rockefellers, some relatives actually of the family. But I'd seen this kind of behavior. And I like to say that if I'd never met these rich American blue blood types, I probably wouldn't have fallen for them. But because I had met them, I knew how eccentric and offbeat they could be. And he seemed offbeat in the same way.
But were you interested in him because he seemed to be wealthy and seemed to be, I mean, he was calling himself a Rockefeller. Did that seem
interesting? Well, it gets your attention.
Well,
I
sure
mean,
does.
You know, I have to think that there was some sort of selfish, almost greedy motive there. It was 1998 when I met him. Everybody was investing in the stock market. Everybody had these online trading accounts and was opening up IRAs and so on. And I remember thinking consciously, oh, someday he might give me a stock tip or something, you know. So I have to absolutely confess to some, you know, wanting to get close to the rich guy motive.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. I don't even know what to make of this, because you had a piece in the New York Times where you write about yourself.
Yeah.
It's called Alter Ego Rattles Author's Ego, written by Walter Kern. That would be you.
Yeah.
And you say, Mr. Kern's prickliness and flashes of arrogance seem to disguise a basic insecurity that may explain why he longed for the approval of a con man posing as a blue blood.
Well, that's the truest sentence in that stunt-like piece I did for the Times.
Is.
You know,
it is.
It's the tender heart of a very sort of comic little piece. You know, at Princeton, I didn't feel comfortable. I felt rejected kind of by the prep school insiders. And I can't say that when a Rockefeller seemed to like me, it didn't feel like redemption.
Did you write this, though, sort of preemptively, write this piece about yourself, in a sense, sort of analyzing yourself and your relationship with this Mr. Rockefeller?
It's nothing I don't say in the book.
No, it
isn't. You know, the book is in some sense a confession of my mixed motives in getting to know this guy. What I really want to analyze in this book is how we get fooled. And the first component, as everybody knows instinctively, is that we want to be. And why did I want to be? Because every deception is a dance. And we've seen it from the point of view of the con artist. I wanted to show a con from the point of view of the dupe.
And that's our guest, Walter Kern, and we're talking about his new book just out called Blood Will Out, and it's subtitled The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet as well, @MartyMossCohen. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcoming clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and relationship problems. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, why Nirvana's Kurt Cobain still matters 20 years after his death. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra supports WHYY and presents Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, Saturday, April 5th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, April 6th at 3 p.m., featuring young Croatian pianist Martina Filijak. Winner of the Cleveland International Piano Competition, Martina brings her poetic passion and technical mastery at the keyboard. Also on the program, Wagner's Prelude to Act 3 of Lohengrin and Strauss's Ein Heldenleben. For information, millersymphonyhall.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Walter Kern. You may have read his previous books, two novels, Up in the Air and Thumbsucker, both of which were made into feature films. We're talking about his new book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. Let's talk a little bit about who it is that we are talking about. This is not Clark Rockefeller, obviously. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who duped you, and a dangerous con man who was actually born in, what, Bavaria?
Yeah, he was born in a little town in Bavaria. His name's Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter. At 17, he came over to the United States. He'd met a couple of Americans while he was hitchhiking one day in Germany, took them to his house for dinner, and after dinner they said, well, if you're ever in the States, give us a call. 2 weeks later, he gave them a call. Right. He landed in Connecticut, and he started studying American manners, especially upper-class manners, and he formed a persona partly based on the millionaire in Gilligan's Island, Jim Backus, Thurston Howell III. He used American TV to give him his sort of first boost into posh behavior.
Using, what, big words and just his tone of speaking and dressing?
Well, you know, He also had the advantage of a book called The Official Preppy Handbook that came out the year he came to America, and it told you that if you wanted to be fancy, you didn't wear socks with your loafers, and you turned up the collar on your polo shirt, etc. And he imitated every piece of advice in this book in fashioning his persona.
And it worked. I mean, he conned so many different people across the country.
It worked. You know, from 17 years old, in Connecticut, he moved to Wisconsin, and then finally to a very fancy suburb of Los Angeles. And all along the way, he'd try new names until by the time he got to Los Angeles, he was a British baronet named Christopher Chichester. That's where something fateful happened.
Well, it was Christopher Mountbatten Chichester,
the 13th
Baronet.
13th Baronet, yes. And he had a business card to prove it. You know, it doesn't take much with people. He cut a swath.
Did you look in any way into, not to psychoanalyze him, but look into his childhood? I mean, why he was such a dangerous con man?
This is one of the most interesting aspects of this story. In 2008, he kidnapped his daughter, and after a custody hearing in Boston, and he was put on trial, and he mounted an insanity defense and hired psychiatrists to look into his own past, or his lawyers did, for evidence of, you know, trauma and insanity, and they really didn't find any. Everything I know about his past shows that, you know, he had a kind of a strained relationship with his parents, but no horrible abuse. He was actually a kind of trickster and mischief maker and maybe even bully, I guess would be the word, from an early age. So I don't know what that tells you. Maybe that he was born this way.
Yeah, but obviously he had some kind of a charm.
Oh, yeah, he had charm. But he had, as I say, even more, the ability to fire your imagination with his strange stories.
He killed somebody.
Yeah, in California he killed somebody when he was about 23 or so years old.
And so when you met him, what, he was on the lam, so to speak?
Yeah. In 1985, he killed a couple, probably. We never have found the woman, but the husband buried in his mother's yard, in the victim's mother's yard. And then he fled the scene, went back to the East Coast and tried on new identities, ultimately becoming Clark Rockefeller. The police were looking for him the whole time, but the trail went cold. So when I met him in 98, he was aware of having kind of lost the people who were tailing him, but he still had one eye in the rearview mirror.
and lived for a while with some of these wealthy families in Connecticut. I guess he got a job in the security business.
Yeah, he got a series of jobs in finance. First in Connecticut at a sort of boutique investment bank, then at a place called Nikko Securities, a large Japanese bank, and then at Kidder Peabody, a firm we've all heard
sure.
of. And he would really kind of walk in off the street and get these jobs on the basis of pretending to be being a member of various private clubs and, affecting a certain manner and dressing a certain way. He really knew that the clothes make the man, so to speak,
And sort of treating in what other, upper-class people would recognize as one of their own?
Yes. One of his techniques was wherever he moved, he would join the High Society Episcopal Church. And he did that in Greenwich. He'd done it back in San Marino, California. And that usually offered him an instant network of well-placed people.
And he married several times. So he lived with people.
He married a couple of times. And here's an interesting trick for budding con artists.
Okay.
He always dated a sister of the person he married before he dated his marriage partner. So he'd find out all about the woman he had his real sights on from her sister, and then he'd come in like he was psychic. First he married for a green card. Then in New York in 1994, he married a woman on her way up who is a Harvard MBA and a very well-paid management consultant.
And you met her?
Yeah, I met her a couple of times. She was sort of a hovering, remote presence. I got the sense that his marriage wasn't good. There was a real chill between them. And I don't think they spent a lot of time together. She traveled a lot, and he really, and it makes sense now in retrospect, was a homebody who, stuck by the hearth.
Because?
Well, he couldn't have a driver's license, for one thing. He couldn't have a bank account. He couldn't do anything which caused him to have to show ID. His only real ID was a German passport, which was a big secret. So he sort of lived a fugitive life in a glorious way. It's a strange mix.
And how did you meet him in 1998?
Well, I got a call from the Humane Society out in Livingston, Montana, that they had a dog in that was crippled, that they'd put up for adoption on the internet, and which had gotten an adoption inquiry from New York from this guy named Clark Rockefeller, who said he couldn't come out and get the dog because his private plane was in China with his wife. I got on the phone with him. I started talking to him. He fascinated me, and I ended up driving the dog to him.
Have you ever done anything like that for anybody else?
No, I haven't.
Drive a dog across the country for a stranger?
It was partly a favor to my wife, who ran the Humane Society. Everybody there thought that the animal shelter was going to get a big donation from this Rockefeller,
That's Walter Kern, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book called Blood Will Out, and it's subtitled The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Elizabeth from Fishtown to join us. And Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I actually met this fellow in 1994 at my cousin's wedding in Boston. His wife had gone to Harvard Business School, and that's where I guess they had met him through her connections there. And my mom and I ended up talking to him at the rehearsal dinner, and we thought, first of all, that it was really odd that he was wearing a seersucker suit at a fairly formal event. And we also thought it was really odd that he was bragging about his aunt only ever drinking Bombay Sapphire gin. That was the gin that both my mom and I solidly middle class drink. So he just really came off as what my mom would call a really funny duck. And we thought it was hilarious when we found out, who he really was. And I still have a chuckle about it every time this comes up in the news or a new movie is released.
Mm-hmm. Is it hilarious, but also just a little scary because this guy's in prison for murder, Elizabeth?
Well, I think that's the closest I've ever come to a murderer, or at least I hope so.
Indeed. Walter Kern, go ahead.
Well, what I didn't hear her say was that she thought he was a total fake and not who he said he was. Funny duck is a good word for describing him, but And you know, he was studying American manners. He may have gotten the brand of gin wrong, but I'll tell you what, he only got it wrong once, because if he was ever corrected, he learned that, you know, what the gin to be drinking was. So, you know, if you knew this guy for a longer amount of time, you would see that he had more stories in his quiver, and he would find a way to charm you, especially if he thought his act wasn't working.
Elizabeth, did you feel like he was performing for you and your mother?
Well, you know, he definitely liked being the center of attention. As I recall, we were in, you know, a group of people kind of standing there talking to him. My great uncle had actually been a pilot for the Rockefeller family, so I think we were all kind of hoping to maybe, you know, hear that he knew, our Uncle Jack, which wasn't the case. But, you know, he definitely liked the attention for sure. But, you know, I definitely agree. His voice was very affected with that sort of, you know, not moving the bottom jaw kind of speech.
The lockjaw talk. Elizabeth, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And to you, Walter Kern, your wife, Maggie, on meeting him says he doesn't listen. He just talks.
Yeah. You know, I was married at the time I met and him, and after we came back from dinner, she said, you know, there's something strange about him. I think he's a narcissist, or he's very self-absorbed. And that was true. I mean, but there's a difference between a narcissist and a murderer, and,
yes.
You know, between somebody who wants all the attention. Looking back, I think one of the reasons he performed this con for so long was that attention really was his fuel, even more than money. You know, some con artists want money so they can escape to an island. I think he just liked standing there soaking up people's, people's attention.
And your mother seemed to be suspicious of him as well.
Yeah,
she didn't like him.
My mother never met him, but when I was delivering the dog, I stopped at her house in Minnesota, and she quizzed me on him and sort of grilled me on him. And she didn't think that anybody who wanted a dog that was sort of this in pain and crippled up was a normal person. She wanted me to put the dog down and sort of abandon the errand. She was right.
We have a tweet from Jay. Proximity to wealth and power is intoxicating. It just is. Book proves it. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, to a certain extent, of course it is. Look at our TV shows. Look at our magazines, the Vanity Fair magazine, etc. You know, this country may pretend that it's all about, you know, the grassroots and so on, but wealth, fame, celebrity, glamour, they all turn our heads. I'm not immune to it. I put myself first in this book to say that, you know, even a good person, and I consider myself one, even a sensible person can be seduced in this way.
And he never seemed to have money to pay for meals, and you would go out with him and you would end up having to pay the meal. And there's a scene in here which I thought was just fascinating, and I think also tells us what an extraordinary con man he was. But you were ready to kind of throw in the towel, say, I've had it, I'm going to make him pay for this lunch. And then he says to you, you know, I consider you my best friend, and I'll tell you why. And obviously he had read your discomfort and perhaps even your anger at him. And then he throws in this best friend thing at you.
Yeah, I was up in Cornish, New Hampshire, visiting his country house. The night before, we'd gone out to dinner, and he'd pretended he'd forgotten his wallet, or he'd never brought it in the first place. And I was sick of him, but the next morning we had breakfast together, and he sort of forced us to have breakfast together, sensing I was going to leave the house. Mm-hmm. And at that breakfast, he laid it on thick and told me that I was the only person he knew who didn't want something from him, and that was because I was an artist, and da-da-da-da. And he reeled me right back in.
So he could read you really well.
Oh, I mean, the guy was like some kind of brain scanner for Homeland Security. He could tell when you were starting to distance yourself and you'd turn on the charm.
And when did this start to fall apart?
For him, it fell apart after he kidnapped his daughter, 2008. He'd been divorced for about a year and lost custody of his 7-year-old. And I'd been on the phone with him throughout that year, sort of counseling him, letting him cry on my shoulder, though he was angrier than he was sad, angry at having sort of lost a poker game with his ex-wife. And then suddenly I I turn on my computer in 2008, August, and see that there's a nationwide Amber Alert. Then I follow the story a little longer and find out that the Rockefeller family's disowned him, and he's not a Rockefeller. Then a couple of weeks go by, and he's a suspect in a murder from 1985. Mm-hmm. It was like falling down the stairs.
Do you think he wanted to murder you? I mean, do you think that ever crossed his mind or was part of his game?
He was a guy, you know, when he killed this John Sohus back in 1985, he buried him in the yard, and then he invited friends over to play a game of Trivial Pursuit on a card table next to the burial mound. Of course, the friends didn't know what was under there. He did. He was a guy who obviously loved sort of morbid secret thoughts, and I think that toward me, he did have malevolent motives. As I wrote this book, people who kind of had inside information came to me and convinced me that there was at least a point where he considered treating me poorly.
Mm, what do you mean by that?
Well, he wanted to move in with me out in Montana. I think New York had gotten hot for him. Maybe some people were on his tail. And he asked if he could come live with me in a guest house, just like the guest house where he'd murdered these people, it turns out. And, you know, he always had literary references around his crimes. He was a fan of film noir and Agatha Christie-style novels. And he told me, or he told these people, that he wanted to translate Dostoevsky, the author of Crime and Punishment, while living at my house. And he never told me when he asked to come stay that he was going to do that. It was a pretty clear tip-off that he had some plans.
Do you think, in hindsight, looking back, and maybe yourself and also others that were conned by this guy, that they just were too polite? That there were things that seemed weird or off-putting or irritating, but they just decided to take the high road and not sort of break the illusion.
I say in the book that the essence of politeness is feigned blindness. A friend of ours comes up and they've gained weight. We don't say, oh, you put on 15 pounds. Or they tell a white lie about why they couldn't meet us for drinks the night before. We don't call them out on it. Well, he knew that the social contract consists of avoiding conflict, of letting little white lies go by, of not jumping on inconsistencies. And he was a kind of hacker of the social code. He knew how to get leverage in situations where people are usually nice or would rather not confront you. And he pushed that.
I mean, because that's sort of, broadly speaking, what upper-class people do, you think?
Well, it's what we all do. You know, I grew up in Minnesota. If you don't have something nice to say about someone, don't say anything, I was taught. And I was also taught to look away when people embarrassed themselves. When I met Clark, he understood that I would cut him a lot of slack in certain situations. And indeed, I did. Underneath, I didn't want him to not be a Rockefeller. I wanted to be friends with this fancy, important guy. I mean, only in retrospect do I realize that.
That's Walter Kern, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans for 20 years. This year's show takes place at the 23rd Street Armory just north of Chestnut Street and runs from Friday evening, April 4th to Sunday the 6th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. Info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
A hurt that won't go away.
My issue is I'm not a statistic. My husband's dead. I don't like hearing, well, statistically there's going to be error. That hurts me in my heart.
A wife and mother caught in a medical error. Veterans fighting a shocking war with the VA created to help them. casualties of a battlefield on the home front. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, where the hospital's new expansion offers the promise of hope and healing to children and their families. Opening this fall, it will include a state-of-the-art emergency department, spacious private rooms, and a nurturing healing garden. Designed by families, for families, it offers advanced pediatric care and peace of mind. More information at Nemours.org. Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Walter Kern. And back in the 1990s, he was conned by a man who claimed to be a member of the wealthy Rockefeller family. They maintained a long relationship in spite of clues in hindsight. The man was an imposter. More than that, he's in prison now, convicted last summer of kidnapping and murder. And that's what Walter Kern writes about in his new book, Blood Will Out. Let me get Sarah from Ambler to join our conversation. And Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to say that watching Borat, you can see how far somebody has to push before anybody suspects they're other than who they are. But I also wanted to ask whether you know, Walter Kern, why the murders were committed, and if it was just for, you know, the joy of killing, or if it was because those people were on to him.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this was a young couple. The man was 27. His wife was about the same age. They worked in a fantasy bookstore in the San Fernando Valley, and they were living with their mother. He was living in the guest house. He killed them, I think, maybe for a financial reason. The mother was old, and he wanted to get into her will and sort of replace the son. You know, he made it look like the son had disappeared. He sent postcards back from the couple that he had forwarded from France that seemed to show that they were on a European vacation and just ignoring their family and friends, instead of being buried in the yard. And he made a deal with some local people to go take care of the old woman once her children were gone and get into her will and then split the take with him. So there was that con. But I also think he was a fan of film noir and murder literature, and I think he really wanted to graduate to the big league and commit the perfect murder to prove that he was smarter than everybody. It was a very intense version of the tricks that he played all the time.
He was a sadist. I mean,
yes,
he enjoyed inflicting this kind of pain on people.
He enjoyed, of course. I mean, anybody who'd throw a board game party on the grave of somebody they have cut up, you know, and this was a very violent crime. He cut this guy up and wrapped him in bags before burying him, and who knows what happened to the wife. So this was somebody who enjoyed a certain level of gruesome, horrible criminal behavior. It wasn't a crime of passion.
You attended his trial. I mean, you watched some of his trial here, and much of the book is about what you observed. When you looked at him, what did he look like?
Well, he put on a strange pose at the trial. First of all, he tried to pretend he was still this sort of socialite fellow. He dressed in a blue blazer and khakis and didn't wear socks. And he had wire-rimmed glasses on. And the moment I remember best was the prosecution showing a slide of the grave in which they dug up the remains of his victim. And he sort of put his glasses down on his nose and peered at it like he was an archaeologist. What are those bones? Should I recognize this? And as though he was investigating the crime, not on trial for it. And right to my left was the victim's sister, you know, sitting in black and crying. And I thought, this little unspeakable name, I hope he really gets it. And I was really afraid he wouldn't. I was afraid he would fool this jury and walk away.
But he didn't. He's in prison for, what, 27, 20-some years?
Well, you know, they call it life in prison, but apparently it comes to 27 years before he can ask for parole. Though I've heard he's talked his way into a minimum security prison in California, which makes no sense to me why someone who'd committed this kind of crime. would be allowed to be in a place they might possibly escape.
Do you hate him?
Hate is a strange word. I mean, we're at quite a distance now. But I dislike him intensely. His first words to me when we last met and he knew I was writing about him, and this was just last August, were, "You betrayed me." And I thought, oh my gosh, the gall, you know. So there's no love lost, that's for sure. And I don't understand him totally either. I don't have any empathy for him because, as far as I can see, he's a complete sadist.
And you did, in my intro, I included what you include near the end of your book, which is when you talk to him in jail, you want to know, you know, how he would seduce somebody like you, and he talks about vanity. Do you think he's right? And it is vanity?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. You know, he told me that everybody wants to be something or fears that they're not something, and he simply gave you the pleasure of pretending that you are that thing. Mm. He plays to your imaginary ideal self, and that's how he gets into your life. And, you know, it was like hearing how to crack safes from a master safe cracker. It had to be the truth because he'd based his life and his career on it.
You're right. Why had no one murdered him? We are a more civilized people than I'd realized for having tolerated such a savage.
Yes. You know, so many people came to the trial and told their stories of him, and a lot like your caller, some of them just found him odd, but some of them he'd treated very badly. And everybody had just sort of, you know, walked away from this bad treatment or ignored him at worst. But, you know, he'd never gotten in any fights, and no one had ever gone after him. And I thought, wow, he really preyed on the kindly nature of our society.
Mm. We have an email from Rod. How was this man able to finance a lifestyle that supported his facade?
Well, he financed it, at least from 1994 on, by getting his wife to sign books of blank checks, which he used to pay for things. And then when she charged much on the credit card, he would yell at her and abuse her, according to her testimony.
Mm. Let me get, looks like Anthony from Bustleton to join us. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Marty.
Sure.
The last caller kind of touched on what I was calling to ask, but do you think that he was like this his whole life, not knowing him as a young boy in Germany or whether it was in the States, or do you think that when he decided or whatever his sick mind came to the conclusion that he had to murder possibly that couple, if not just the man, do you think that might have changed him and shaped him into the sociopath or neurological problems that he has now?
Yeah, Anthony, go ahead.
No, he started this way. He told another journalist that as a kid, he enjoyed taking the street signs in his little village and taking them off their posts and switching them around so people would drive around lost. He used to put pepper into his palm and then close his hand, and he'd bring his hand up to somebody's face and like acting like he'd caught a frog or something and get them to look, and then he'd blow the pepper up their nose and into their eyes. This was a kid who always enjoyed tricking and causing pain.
Do you see this as a cautionary tale? I mean, what the book that you've written, that this is a cautionary tale, not just for you, but for all of us.
The month that Clark Rockefeller was exposed as a fraud was also the month that the American economy fell apart in 2008. We learned about characters like Bernie Madoff, and firms like Lehman Brothers turned out to be kind of casinos rather than real banks. And I wrote this book for anybody who's ever been deceived, and we all have been. You know, we all went to war over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that were never found. They were a lot like the key to Rockefeller Center, which was in his pocket, but I never actually looked at. I want to analyze how we're deceived and how we deceive ourselves, because it happens at more important levels than my relationship with this fellow. And I want us to understand so it happens a little less.
But it's so interesting, and I agree with you. I think all of us, this is really extreme, but all of us have had to deal with, probably in one way or another, with someone who wasn't who they seemed to be. But there is a kind of shame in realizing that someone has either conned us or deceived us, that we feel shame.
The con artist You know, con artists have long careers often, and that's because the victims are so ashamed to report it. It's sort of like rape used to be, where people would rather keep it to themselves than admit they were a victim. And they depend on shame, and I decided not to have any when I wrote this book.
Do you feel like a victim?
Yeah, I do, because once your trust has been abused at this level, it's a little hard to go on with quite the confidence and zing that you used to.
But you got a book out of this.
I got a book out of it. That's the deal that writers get. They live life and maybe sometimes a painful episode of life, but they do get a book.
And do we know if he's read it or not?
I'm sure. As your last caller said, he loved being the center of attention, and I don't think he misses a word that's written about him.
So you are sort of continuing to feed his vanity, you think, from afar? Obviously, he's in prison.
Everything feeds his vanity. Mm-hmm. He finds a way for every minute of every day to increase the size of his ego.
In fact, a comment from Sarah, does Kern think that Clark is thrilled that someone is writing a book about him?
I know he is. When I talk to him in prison, you know, a lot of this book is me visiting him in prison after his trial. He knew every bit of press he'd had. Here's the most monstrous thing he ever said to me. I met him a week after the Boston Marathon bombing, and he'd been living in Boston when he was caught for kidnapping. And I said, what did you think about this bombing? And he said, oh, it was terrible, but for me it wasn't such bad news. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, people in Boston spend all their time talking about me. And now with this bombing, they have something else to talk about.
Oh, my gosh. I want to take a shower.
I sure did.
Why did you keep wanting to go to prison, though, to talk to him? Was it for a book, or was it to try to figure out who this person was for yourself?
Well, no journalist had talked to this guy since 2008 when he went to jail. His lawyers hadn't allowed it. And after the murder trial, suddenly he was available. So as a journalist, I wanted to. But I had last known him as Clark Rockefeller. You know, a lot of revelations had come during this time, and I wanted to confront him. And the first thing I said was, you know, what's going on, man? And he compared himself to an addict and said, oh, he couldn't help what he'd done. And, you know, he denied the murder. And he started reeling me back in, too, by suggesting that there were secrets in his life of crime that he would tell only me. And he actually asked if I would write a biography of him.
Let me get Lisa from Doylestown to join our conversation. Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I've been listening to your guest, and I could not help but begin to feel like this guy was the Patricia Highsmith character of Thomas Ripley in the trilogy of Thomas Ripley novels that she wrote, just the deception and wanting the good life and the murder.
Bingo.
And also another character from the movie A Kiss Before Dying, where Robert Wagner played the college student who dated the sister of the woman and killed the sister, but of the woman he would eventually get engaged to, when you said about, you know, dating the sister. And I just thought, wow, this guy must have been reading or watching the same movies and books that I've been watching.
Well, that's a big
part of the book. That's a big part of my book. I actually dissect his crimes using film noir and books, and Ripley's one of them. You know, he covered up his crime the same way Ripley covered his, by writing fake letters from the victim.
Lisa, thanks for a very careful reading of this story. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. We have an email from Ed. Were the Rothkos another art? Were they fake?
Yes, they were fake. But, you know, he lived down the hall in this building from a big art dealer in New York, and she has said that she thought they were real. He fooled everyone for a time. They were very good counterfeits, yes.
And he wanted to give them to you, right?
After the trial, he told me that he had these paintings in a locker in Maryland, and he wanted me to take possession of them. He said they might be worth something someday, not because they were real, they were counterfeits, but because they'd belong to him. They were Clark Rockefeller counterfeits. And he tried to use, you know, some sort of greed in me to get me to take possession of all these things that he kept in a locker. And I wanted no part of it. For all I knew, there was evidence in there that he wanted to hide.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. We have Rose from Fleetwood, Pennsylvania, joining us. Hi, Rose. Go ahead. We're almost out of time.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was just curious about the dog. It seems weird that the whole start of Mr. Kern's story is because of this crippled dog.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you think this man entered that into the whole grand scheme of things? Like, why would he bother with this crippled dog?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rose. Go ahead.
That's a story I tell in the book. The dog was part of a con that was way above my head. Let's put it that way. Number two, walking a dog that was in a doggy wheelchair in Central Park every day gets you a lot of sympathy and a lot of attention. It's not uncommon for sociopaths and psychopaths to come on as animal lovers as a way of making themselves seem human and compassionate.
Rose, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Your other books, Up in the Air and Thumbsucker, were made into movies. Is this going to be made into a movie, do you think? Or
I certainly hope so. I've been approached about a sort of TV series, kind of in the True Detective vein, or a movie. You know, it's unclear to me how it might reach the screen and what kind of screen it'll reach, but I think it would make a great story on screen, yeah.
I'm not a big believer in closure, but do you feel like you have some closure on this chapter in your life?
Well, you know, we've all been fooled by someone, but we don't often get to see the person who fooled us tried for murder and convicted and sent to life in prison. That's about as much closure and confirmation of your own point of view as you're going to get. But the guy's still alive, he's still out there, and he's going to play tricks for the rest of his life.
Well, Walter Kern, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called Blood Will Out, and it's subtitled The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. And our guest, Walter Kern, also the author of two novels, Up in the Air and Thumbsucker. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can continue our conversation. You can also find out about podcasts and Twitter, Facebook, satellite radio archives, and email. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.